From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In August of 1990, people around the world watched an Iraqi video in which Saddam Hussein tried to coax a scared but defiant British boy toward him, a propaganda effort on the part of Saddam that failed. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the boy's mother, Glenda Lockwood. She's written a book about her family's captivity in Baghdad called Diary of a Human Shield. Also today, myth, folktales, and magic of the American South. We meet writer Randall Keenan. He's been called the African-American Gabriel Garcia Marquez for the ways in which he weaves magic and reality. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Check Your Head, the new album by the Beastie Boys. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush today issued a broad defense of his environmental record and promised U.S. assistance to conserve the world's forests. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush said the United States will contribute $150 million to the effort by developing nations to conserve their forests. However, the bulk of the president's remarks, delivered at the Goddard Space Flight Center, seemed to answer critics who charged that he hasn't lived up to his 1988 campaign promise to be the environmental president.
When we go to Rio, the U.S. will go proudly as the world's leader, not just in environmental research, but in environmental action.
Mr. Bush cited advances in cleaning the air, supplementing national parks, banning oil and gas drilling in environmentally sensitive areas, and stopping the export of toxic waste, as examples, he says, of ways in which U.S. environmental laws are models for the world. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The State Department said today that about $200 million in assets belonging to the Yugoslav government have been frozen in keeping with the United Nations embargo. The UN Security Council imposed the sanctions on Saturday in an effort to force the remaining Yugoslav republics, Serbia and Montenegro, to stop supporting the civil wars in Bosnia and Croatia. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said today that the United States doesn't expect that the embargo will force any immediate changes in the behavior of the Serbian leadership. The New York Times reported today that Belgrade may have shifted much of its $1.5 billion in foreign currency reserves from Western banks to secret accounts in Cyprus. El Salvador's government and left-wing rebels were criticized today in a report by the United Nations Secretary General Boutros-Ghali for delays in implementing UN-brokered peace accords. From San Salvador, Tom Gibb has details.
The report says there have been grave delays in carrying out the agreement signed by the two sides in January. This, it concludes, is undermining confidence. In particular, the report says that neither side has yet concentrated all of its forces into separate areas of the country. It criticizes government failure to disband two of the old security forces and rebel failure to start to disarm. However, the UN Secretary General praises both sides for strict observance of a ceasefire, which came into effect at the beginning of February. There have been no violations. The peace process was supposed to end in October this year, but it now looks as if it will take much longer. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
Stock prices were up sharply today on Wall Street, pushing the Dow Index above the 3,400 level for the first time in history. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 16 points to close at a record 3,413. This is NPR News. Russia officially became part of the International Monetary Fund today, but officials say it'll be some time before Russia becomes eligible for major loans. The United States and other leading industrial nations have pledged $24 billion this year in assistance for Russia to change to a free market economy. IMF sources said that most of that money won't be available until Russia has an economic program in place that the Monetary Fund will approve. The sources said that an IMF team that recently returned from Moscow was disappointed with the pace of reforms there. Thailand's parliamentary president has put off the nomination of a new prime minister, saying the situation is too tense to make a controversial choice now. Mary Kay Magstad reports from Bangkok.
Thai parliamentary president Artit Yurirat is in an unenviable position. He was appointed by the military leaders of last year's coup, who still expect him to represent their interests. But he is also being pressured by the Thai middle class which is fed up with the military trying to dominate Thai politics. Each side has its own ideas of who should be the next prime minister. Pro-democracy activists have vowed to take to the streets again if another military crony is appointed, but the military has also threatened to take drastic action if its interests are threatened. Artit's solution, announced today, is to delay naming a new prime minister for 10 days until key amendments are passed. These are designed to make the constitution more democratic and require that all future prime ministers be elected, not appointed. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Bangkok.
The nation's manufacturing sector continued to improve in May, growing for the fourth month in a row. The latest survey by the National Association of Purchasing Management shows strong gains in production, new orders, and exports. Employment levels among American manufacturers were also the highest they've been in more than 3 years. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I'm going to ask you to remember back to August of 1990, after Iraq invaded Kuwait and Western hostages were being held in Baghdad as human shields to deter an attack against Iraq. The Iraqis made a TV program which was seen around the world, in which Saddam Hussein spoke to about 24 British hostages and tried to demonstrate how well they were being treated. He put his arm around a 5-year-old British boy and patted his head. But the boy did not respond, for which he became a hero, later to be awarded for his courage. My guest is the boy's mother, Glenda Lockwood. In 1990, she, her husband, and 2 sons were living in Kuwait, where her husband worked as an engineer. After the invasion, all the men in the British compound where they lived were rounded up by the Iraqis and taken to Baghdad. The women and children later joined their husbands as hostages. Glenda Lockwood has written a book about this harrowing experience called Diary of a Human Shield. We invited her to speak with us from the BBC studios in Birmingham, England, where the family now lives. She told me about the support system the women formed in Kuwait when their husbands were taken away.
There were only certain houses on the compound that actually had telephones. So as quickly, I don't really know how it happened, but it all seemed to fit into place. Women seemed to scuttle from house to house, and we ended up with three women and several children in our house where there was a telephone. And we tried to use all the houses with telephone link-ups so that we could keep in constant touch via the telephone. All the curtains were drawn, obviously, at that point, and we barricaded ourselves in with boxes, packing boxes and things that we'd, you know, sort of done the day previous to occupy our minds, really. But The actual system of being, you know, together as a community, it just happened. And, you know, I'm glad that I was with the set of women that I was with, because they were all tremendous, and the children also.
Did the Iraqi soldiers try to take advantage of the fact that there were a lot of women without men around?
I think so. Yes, I do. They knew exactly what they were doing, but to be fair, I mean, if you can be fair in a situation like that, a lot of the soldiers who were there were young, not professional soldiers. I mean, they stole as many cars as they could possibly stole, and they just literally screamed round corners and bumped into whatever they could until the petrol ran out. And, you know, it was very, very frightening. The whole situation of being there with soldiers like that on camp was very, very frightening.
A couple of the women who you knew were sexually assaulted during that period.
That's right, yes. Yeah, that was, I think, perhaps one of our worst moments down there. It was something that we feared might happen and eventually did happen. If I could just explain that a little bit. Mm-hmm. The house that the soldiers went into, that the assault took place in, was the house that we managed to get food sent to. So they probably went there initially to get food supplies. But obviously it went a little bit further than expected, and the attack wasn't very nice at all. I mean, it was, it was terrible, because they were attacked in front of children, you know, and I mean, that an attack anyway is bad, but to have small children, from the smallest being, I think, about 2 years, to the oldest, which would have been about 13, 11, 12, 13, you know, was absolutely atrocious.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Glenda Lockwood. She's joining us from England. She's written a book called Diary of a Human Shield about the period in August of 1990, when she was one of the British citizens who were being held in Iraq as a human shield. And by the way, her younger son, Stuart, was the 5-year-old who resisted Saddam Hussein's display of friendliness in the videotape that we all watched that summer. So, from your homes in Kuwait, you went on a convoy to the International Hotel in Kuwait City. From there, you went on a convoy to Iraq to be reunited where your husbands were being held. You write in your journals that the real fear emerged after you were reunited with your husband, because there was no immediate goal after that. You were together, and then you really didn't know what was going to happen next.
Yeah, my biggest worry, I mean, I didn't feel that way. I mean, I was so relieved to see Derek. It didn't hit me at that time, but sort of the middle of the night, I woke up and Derek was actually stood on the balcony, and you could see the look of worry on his face straight away. And I think that's when it first hit me that, you know, before that, I think he thought that we'd be okay, we would get home, and it would just be himself to worry about. But when we were all sort of reunited back together, he'd got the whole family to worry about again.
We all saw the videotape in August of 1990. Of Saddam Hussein putting his arm around your younger son, Stuart, and in an attempt to show Saddam as like the friendly uncle. But Stuart stood by, resisting Saddam's affection, looking nervous and distant and not playing into it at all. You walked in the middle of that scene. Would you describe what it was like to walk in on that and how that happened?
Yes, we actually knew that he was there, I must be fair. What had happened was I was actually tidying the room where we used to eat, sleep, do whatever. And I looked out of the window and saw lots of soldiers. Now, previous to this, Derek, my husband, had been asked if he'd go and have a look at a video recorder that wasn't working. And Stuart, because he'd been separated from his daddy previously, wouldn't leave his daddy's side, so he was obviously with him. Now, when I looked out and saw all these soldiers, I started to panic because, you know, sort of a situation like that, you never know what's coming next, and your mind sort of races forward into all sorts of states. So I walked through to the area. As I walked through, Saddam Hussein was actually stood in the middle of the reception area with Stuart actually at his side. I didn't know, I just froze for a moment, and they sort of walked on and I backed up and let the other people know where we were, the rooms that were the other side, what was going on. And by this time a guard had come to us and asked us to join them in the lounge, which is why it appeared that we walked in later. When I actually walked into the room and saw Stuart really being coaxed towards him, of course I was frightened at first. You know, I didn't know what to expect. But the atmosphere that Saddam Hussein was actually trying to portray seemed to be reasonably friendly at that time. So we just sat down as we were told to do, and he sort of continued with his explanation of why we were being held, etc. That basically is how I came to walk into the middle of it.
Do you know how Saddam Hussein picked out Stuart? Do you have any idea of that?
No, I don't actually, because even... I mean, we've been in the Middle East 4 years. The Arabs particularly are very fond of fair-headed children, and there was a lovely little girl there who with fair hair, slightly younger than Stuart. I mean, perhaps he'd have got more response from her, but no, I've no other explanation whatsoever.
What did Stuart say to Saddam?
He didn't really say anything at all. He only answered him when he was asked questions. That was all he said. Saddam Hussein got nothing more from Stuart.
Do you want to review for us the questions that Saddam Hussein asked him and what he responded?
Well, he asked him if he was getting his milk, and Stuart said yes. And then I think Stuart added cornflakes too. And then Saddam Hussein said, well, that's probably more than a lot of Iraqi children were getting. And then he asked if they played games, and they said yes. And he asked what games they played, and he said football and, you know, things outside. And he asked if they played with the Iraqis, you know, the guards, and they said yes.
How was Stuart usually with strangers?
Stuart's always been fine. He's a very friendly, amiable little boy. We've never ever seen the reaction that Saddam Hussein got from him. I like to think it's sort of like a second nature to him, you know, but he really is a very friendly little boy normally.
Do you know if he realised who it was?
I'm sure he did, because on that 28-hour drive up from Kuwait to Baghdad, wherever you go, sort of a mile or two down the road, you see huge big sort of posters of Saddam Hussein. And whenever you turn the television on, he's constantly on the television. So I'm sure he recognised him. He knew he was important, but I don't think he knew who he actually was.
Did you have any idea the kind of impact that scene was going to make on the rest of the world?
To be honest with you, at that time, no. We looked... The surprise that it actually gave us, him just turning up there and doing that, seemed to numb us for a while. It was only sort of afterwards that we realised, we had a shortwave radio and we heard that, you know, the world was outraged by the video and, you know, it all sort of brought it home then, I think, you know, that the impact of it. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that we weren't aware that we were all being used as part of his propaganda machine. We all knew that. We all knew it was a propaganda stunt. But the actual surprise of him turning up seemed to actually numb us. And the impact of the video with Stuart resisting at that particular time, we were proud of him because he'd resisted. I mean, he's a true, like we say, little British bulldog, or he was at that time. But... you know, the actual impact, we didn't realise at that point that it was going to be so strong. That was one of the main reasons why I decided to write the book, because I felt that he'd had so much, not pressure, pressure's the wrong word, but so much attention maybe paid to him. And he obviously knows that now it's all because of Saddam Hussein, that I felt that he should have a written account of actually what all the fuss was about when he got older. So that's the nice point of view of having the book, to give both my boys, my elder boy and my younger son, the book when they get older.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Glenda Lockwood, and she's written a book called Diary of a Human Shield, and it's about the summer of 1990 when she and her family were among the hostages held in Iraq before the start of the war. Her younger son, Stuart, was the 5-year-old who resisted Saddam Hussein's display of affection. And we all saw that videotaped that summer. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Glenda Lockwood is joining us from England. She's written a new book called Diary of a Human Shield. A few days after the now infamous videotape was made, women and children were allowed to leave Iraq and return home. Mm-hmm. But they were given the option of staying. And it was a very difficult choice for you to make, whether to stay or go. Can you talk with us about how you and your husband decided that you would leave with the children?
Yes, it was a decision that we anticipated previously. Both my husband and I had talked about it, and Derek had actually said if the choice was made and they allowed women and children to go, that there was no decision to be made. He decided that we would go and that was the end of it. But that didn't make it any easier when they actually put that decision before us. I'll always remember this. This is, as I said previously, was my worst moment without a doubt. I mean, we had one of the children in the installation where we were had actually had a birthday, and the guard had made him a birthday cake or obtained a birthday cake, and we'd had like a small get together. And it was one of the guards had gone out to do something or other, and he came in. It must have been about 11 o'clock, and said that the president had just announced that women and children were going to be released, but some definite news would be heard the next day. Well, I became very upset by this because I knew that the next day, you know, we would have a decision to make, and I think I cried most of the night that night, worrying about it. And Derek was also worried, obviously, but, I mean, his decision was made and that was the end of it. When the next day came and the guards came round asking who was going to be travelling, both myself and Craig, that's my oldest son, both said we didn't want to go and we would like to stay. But as I said previously, Derek had made the decision that we were all going and there was no decision to be made. Yes, they would be travelling. So we were then that afternoon told that we had 15 minutes to get our things together and we would be going, and that was it, really. We were taken away on a bus to the ever-famous Mansour Melia Hotel, and Derek was left in the installation.
What was your goodbye like?
Oh, it was awful, absolutely awful. I think this is one thing that sticks in Stuart's mind. We were all sort of put on a bus, and it was so upsetting. I mean, even some of the guards there, they were civilian guards, this installation. Even some of those made Derek get back on the bus to say our goodbyes again because he could see that we were all so upset. But the actual pulling off and saying goodbye to him was terrible.
Jesse Jackson had flown to Iraq to try to negotiate the release of the hostages, and he was on your plane that was taking you back home. And he asked for you and Stuart to go to the front of the aircraft to sit with him and talk mm-hmm. with him. What did you do, and what was your reaction to his request?
Well, we went to the front of the plane. One of the guards who was on the plane with us had come down and said, "Would we go up and say hello to him?" So we did do, and he was charming. He really was. But at that point, it was just sort of hello, and he asked if we'd like to join him in the first class compartment, which we said no to. We'd sort of made a lot of friends, and we were with all our old friends, so we didn't think it was fair to do that. And then they'd asked us if they could do a short interview with Stuart, which, you know, I sort of said, well, I don't, you know, at that particular time, I don't know whether you're going to get much joy out of him. You know, after the business with Saddam Hussein, I thought, you know, this is the end of it. So I actually went back to my seat, and, you know, that was the end of it. He did do an interview on the plane. He did come over. And surprisingly enough, Stuart sat on his knee and was talking quite amiably to him, you know. So that was quite nice, really.
We all saw the news footage of Jesse Jackson leaving the plane carrying your son Stuart. How did that come to be?
That I was a little bit cross about, because we were all... The actual leaving when we flew out of Baghdad was very upsetting, because, you know, obviously the final stage of actually going up in the airplane and Derek still being there was very upsetting for us. But the landing in London, I'd had a message at the airport in Baghdad that my sister and brother-in-law were going to be there waiting at Heathrow. So after going through all that, all I wanted to do was get off the plane and go and see them, you know. And we got through to Heathrow, and no warning whatsoever, we came down the steps. And halfway down the steps, Jesse Jackson was actually stood there waving, you know, and we just thought, oh, it's for a photo corner, didn't think anything of it. And as we went to pass him, he actually picked Stuart up and led us to a bank of photographers on the tarmac, more or less for not a press conference, it was just like a photo call, really. I mean, he did say a few words, I think. I was not really with it at that particular time. And then he took us over to the bus, and we went on through to Heathrow to meet our relatives.
So did you feel that Jackson was being opportunistic in carrying out Stuart?
That's difficult to comment on. It's been said since then that perhaps he used him in the same way, you know, for publicity circumstances. I don't know. I really don't know. I don't really want to comment on that one.
That's fine. Do you feel that Jackson probably contributed to your release?
Again, I don't know. I really don't know. I think what he did by going to Kuwait and going and helping as many people as he could there was a wonderful thing. I mean, I do think that was great. But from our own point of view, I really don't know. I mean, we were actually sat at the airport waiting for his plane to come in. We were delayed because Jesse Jackson was coming back from Kuwait. We sat there from 4 o'clock in the afternoon until almost 1 o'clock in the morning waiting. So by that time, we were all very, very tired, and we just wanted to get on with our journey and get home, you know.
I think it was about 3 months after you returned home to England that your husband was released. Was he very changed by those 3 months?
Oh, he looked awful. He really did look awful. He came back, he must have lost 4, 4.5 stone. And he looked absolutely awful. He really did. I mean, I'd had news from people filtering out previously that he hadn't been well, but nothing had prepared me for how he was going to look when he came through. But at the same time, we were just so relieved to have him home. And, you know, he's fine again now. So, you know, it's just a matter of being together and mending everything.
What do you think the after effects have been on your younger son, Stuart, the one who was in the videotape with Saddam Hussein?
Well, on the whole, he's gone back to sort of being a normal 7-year-old boy he is now. He's just had a birthday. On the whole, he's a normal 7-year-old boy. He's a very happy child. There's no doubt about that. He really is. He lives life to its fullest. But at the same time, the whole situation has made him a little bit insecure. He's very panicky in strange situations. We did have a few bad dreams, but they seem to be easing off a little bit now. But if we're in a strange place, he's very, very clingy. And if he knows, you know, if he knows that you're, if he's going somewhere, if he's going to a party of a friend or something, he's constantly checking with you. You'll be picking me up, won't you? Stand here, you know, don't stand over there. Stand here where I can see you. And he does seem a little bit insecure that way. He also doesn't like long car journeys. He tends to have this fear that we're going to get lost, you know, if we're going on holiday or anything and we're in the car. He keeps constantly reminding you, you do know the way, you know. And but I think on the whole, he's beginning to, you know, get himself back together again.
You've made it clear in your diaries how strong and dependable and heroic you felt your older son, who was 14 at the time, was throughout the ordeal. He, of course, never got the international attention that your younger son did. Do you think he resented that at all?
No, I don't. He's had the opportunity to actually take part in a lot of the media attention that's happened, but he's chosen, I think it's sort of 14, 15, 16, it doesn't do their image too much good to be sort of flashed on television or what have you. So I think from that point of view, he's chosen to be in the background. He doesn't resent Stuart whatsoever. And I mean, as you said previously, I'm very, very proud of Craig. Without Craig, I honestly don't know if the situation would have resolved as calmly as it did from our own family's point of view. You know, he had to take his dad's place. He did things for me that really you don't expect a 14-year-old boy to sort of have the responsibility of doing. And he also had the worry about his dad because he knew that he was out there. He knew the situation. He understood the media that was happening. He understood the situation with the war and everything. So he had all those added pressures too. But no matter how much attention, you know, he doesn't get, he knows that he's always, you know, very, very special in our books.
Would you ever want to return to Kuwait, where you lived for 4 years?
No, definitely not. I loved Kuwait. The whole family loved Kuwait, I should say, really. And I mean, I've been on to Kuwait this morning to my friends out there. I miss it. I truly do miss it. But no, we would never get back there.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Glenda Lockwood's new book is Diary of a Human Shield. It's published in London by Bloomsbury and distributed in the States by Trafalgar Square. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Writer Randall Keenan says growing up in rural North Carolina, he could feel the presence of his dead relatives. Coming up, we talk with Keenan about spirits, family, magic, and folklore in the American South. He has a new book of short stories called Let the Dead Bury Their Dead. And rock critic Ken Tucker has something good to say about the Beastie Boys' latest album, Check Your Head. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. After reports surfaced over the weekend that Secretary of State James Baker might step down to run the president's reelection campaign, a denial was issued today by the State Department. Spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler says Baker is not quitting and that he has not talked to the president about resigning. Barry Schwide reports.
Baker's worked for three presidents, Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan, and George Bush, and his ties to Bush, a friend from Houston for some 30 years, are exceptionally strong. It would be hard to imagine Baker turning him down, but it's also hard to imagine the president asking Baker to step down. That would be an acknowledgment that the Bush reelection campaign is in trouble and that running foreign policy isn't as essential as helping the president run for reelection. Baker is in the midst of trying to manage a policy on Yugoslavia, as that fractured nation sinks closer to anarchy, and to keep Arabs and Israelis interested in peace talks. Also, Baker has made steering the START missile reduction treaty to ratification and implementation a pet project, working long hours on it. And yet, there's never been any question his first loyalty is to his long-term friend, George Bush. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Political turmoil continued today in Haiti as the 8-month-old military leadership stepped up its crackdown on anti-government protest. In the meantime, the Bush administration continues to send back home hundreds of Haitian boat people. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Haitian radio stations reported anti-government classroom demonstrations today in high schools throughout the nation's capital of Port-au-Prince. The protests occurred on the first day of classes, which resumed today after being suspended following similar demonstrations last week. Police also stepped up their presence throughout the capital to clamp down on protests, calling for the return of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was ousted in a September military coup. Plainclothes police, armed with submachine guns, scaled a wall and arrested three girls in a school courtyard. And a boy carrying a photograph of exiled President Aristide was also arrested outside a second school. Meanwhile, the U.S. Coast Guard picked up nearly 1,000 Haitian boat people today and forcibly returned them, despite attempts by U.S. human rights activists to block the process. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
Russia has now signed up to become a member of the International Monetary Fund. However, there are reports that Moscow still has a lot of work to do before enough economic changes are made for a program in Russia that the IMF will be willing to support and to give financial aid to. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 16 points to close at 3,413.21, a record, on volume of some 181 million shares. Trading was active. This is NPR News. Less than 2 hours after a new ceasefire went into effect in Bosnia, the capital again came under fire by Serbian forces. According to an eyewitness, Sarajevo was hit by shelling from Serbian-held hills above the city. The main post office was hit 3 times. This latest ceasefire was worked out by UN peacekeepers and accepted yesterday by all sides. Residents had hoped this latest truce would hold because of pressure of UN sanctions placed on Serbia. In Belgrade, officials have announced oil conservation measures to counter UN sanctions, which experts say can cripple much of Serbia's economy. France's new government has just barely survived a censure motion in Parliament. It had been put forward by the right-wing opposition to protest the government's decision to endorse cuts in farming subsidies in Europe. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The socialist government of Prime Minister Pierre Bergoglio does not have a majority in Parliament tonight, before the votes were cast, Barry Gavois pleaded with legislators to rally behind the government. But as expected, the main right-wing parties and the communists voted against him. This is the second time in 4 years that the communists have supported a no-confidence vote against the socialists. Thanks to the support of a few maverick centrists, however, Barry Gavois survived. The censure motion failed to be passed by only 3 votes. Although the government is certain to be relieved, this vote shows what a fragile base it has in Parliament. And that's not Barry Gavois' only concern. The socialists face legislative elections next year, and if they lose those, they'll be out of power. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
A spokesman for Yasser Arafat says that the PLO leader has undergone brain surgery for blood clots caused by a plane crash in April. A hospital spokesman in Amman said that Arafat is in good and stable condition after a 90-minute operation. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Randall Keenan has been called the Black Gabriel Garcia Marquez because of how he weaves folktales, magic, and reality. Keenan's stories are set in the fictional town of Timms Creek, North Carolina, which is modeled on Chinkapin, where he grew up. He was raised by his great aunt on a farm that had been in the family since emancipation. He left home for college and since then has worked as an assistant editor at Knopf and now teaches at Sarah Lawrence and Columbia. Keenan is working on a travel book about the history of African American communities in places through North America which are not associated with Black culture. He's the author of the 1989 novel A Visitation of Spirits, and he has a new collection of short stories called Let the Dead Bury Their Dead. Here's a reading from the first story, Clarence and the Dead, about a boy who gets messages from the dead. This passage is about the boy's birth.
On the day Clarence Bickett died, Wilma Jones's hog, Francis, stopped talking. Now, of course, no one else had ever heard the swine utter word the first. But Wilma swore up and down that the creature had first said to her Jesus wept on a sunny day in June. But the peculiar thing was that Wilma had not known of Clarence's death when she declared the hog's final hushing up. And oddly enough, it was on the exact day of Clarence's birth, 5 years before, that Wilma had commenced preaching that the hog could talk. They say that day the sun shone while the rain poured. The old folks say that's when the devil beats his wife. The day Estelle Pickett died, giving birth to Clarence. Her mama was out in the cucumber patch when Estelle went into labor, and we came to get her. Miss Eunice, not being an excitable woman, asked the midwife if it had been sent for. And when we said yeah, she insisted on topping off her bushel before heading home. Estelle's papa, Mr. George Edward, was away in Wilmington that day looking for a new tractor since he was sick and tired of his old farm all breaking down every other row and needing some more oil than gasoline. We never knew if Miss Eunice blamed herself, because she never admitted to it, one, and two, we never saw much sign that she did. We all arrived at the picket place at the same time as the midwife. We walked in on one of the most hideous sights we can remember seeing or hearing tell of. There lay Estelle on the bed, her legs apart, her eyes rolled back in her head, her body kind of twisted to the side, and the pool so deep red it could have been maroon sheets she was sitting on instead of white. And on the floor, squalling like a stuck pig, was Clarence, a twitching, pitiful little thing in a soup of blood and purple mess. There won't no call to worry about being over his face as people come to gossip, just not so. The call seemed to be everywhere else, though, on his head, on his hands, on his belly like a raw liver, quivery and oozy, him coated in a mucky white paste like snot, a mess enough to make you lose your breakfast. Miss Eunice went to fix him up straight away, and the midwife looked to Estelle. She's gone, child, poor thing, she said.
Whose voice are you reading in? Because it's a different voice than you speak in.
It's a voice very much like the voice I grew up around. The people who brought me up spoke something like that.
Do you end up speaking more like that when you visit your home?
It's strange. It's a strange schizophrenia. When I'm there, I speak that way. When I leave, I drop it very quickly.
So you're bilingual in a way.
Yeah, I'm bilingual in a way.
Did you ever walk in on a scene like the one you described in the end of that reading?
No, I have never walked in on that. I might not be here. I might have expired.
How is the spirit world treated in your family?
Growing up, I heard, not only did people die in every room of the house, but there were stories probably attached to each dead member coming back and conversations and strange goings-on. I was an enormously mortified child. I was scared of the dark until I was about 16 years old. And it was a very palpable thing.
Can you give us a sense of one of the stories that would be likely to have scared you?
Stories like the night my great-grandmother died, my great-aunt who brought me up talks about her talking to her after she was dead, not knowing that she was dead. Or stories about her father and her mother and brother, all dead, coming back to take care of her when she was sick and didn't leave the house for 3 days. And just, you know, strange signs that let her know or left her in doubt as to whether or not they were there or whether she was hallucinating. And, you know, a 60-year-old woman telling the story with great conviction to a 5-year-old boy doesn't leave much doubt in the 5-year-old boy's mind that these things are apt to happen.
When you were coming of age and approaching college time, were you drawn? Were there conflicting pressures on you to leave and to stay? Was that a difficult decision to make?
Well, I think Toni Morrison probably said it best when she said, "All black people who realize that they want to succeed in some way—I'll leave that a vague term—know that they have to go away." One of the things that sort of makes Tim's Creek attractive to me is the fact that it is becoming something of a diaspora. It's more people are going away than are living there. More people are dead citizens there than are living. And it was just an understood thing that for me to, when I was in high school, I really wanted to be a physicist. And my first 3 years in college were studying physics. And there was no way I was going to get a job in any research firm in that part of the country. And everybody knew it. But they were very supportive. And implicit in that was the fact that you had to go away.
Mm-hmm. In your novel, the main character's brother and sister had moved north to go to college. And they tell him to get out. And he thinks, well, if we all get out, who will stay?
Right, exactly. It's a horrible dilemma. And as I say, the Keenan family is something of a diaspora. We're strung literally all over the world. I'm talking about the huge extended family, the descendants of my great-great-grandparents. And it is, when we get together, we talk about, all the shared values and that historical time in which, you know, our forebears were very close in that tiny geographical area. And ideas about how we could all pull it back together. But, of course, that's something of a fantasy.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Randall Keenan. His new collection of short stories is called Let the Dead Bury Their Dead. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Randall Keenan is my guest. When was the last time you were back to your hometown of North Carolina?
I go there quite often. In fact, I sort of left New York for the year to do this travel book, and when I'm not on the road, I'm back home.
And who has survived of the people who brought you up?
Well, my great-aunt, the one who raised me, not my great-great-aunt. She, in fact, died in February. A few of the old folk. It's really sort of very sad. A lot of people have died in the last 10 years.
Are there any of the young people in your family left there?
Most of the ones I was closest to are gone. They're either in the big cities of North Carolina, Washington, Atlanta, or New York.
How did you start writing? How did that become important to you?
I had always written. I scribbled down 2 novels when I was in high school. They will never see the light of day, and I will never read them again. But I always, as I said, my mother had taught me to read when I was, before I got to kindergarten. So I'd always been in love with words, but growing up in the country, Writing was never something I thought I could do as a profession or, you know, actually make any money at, because you didn't see any writers when you were growing up in Duplin County. So that's how I chose science. And when I got to college, I was thinking, well, I'm going to do what Isaac Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke do. I'm going to become a great scientist and write science fiction on the side. And I started studying writing. And I ran into some very formidable teachers who said, well, look, you come from this great heritage. You shouldn't be writing about aliens and Mars. You should be writing about your background and the people you know there. And I resisted. And in that resisting, I read a lot of wonderful works by people like Toni Morrison and Ralph Ellison, and I was won over. And I slowly let the physics melt away, and I wound up becoming, you know, the starving writer in New York.
I'm curious if it was white teachers or black teachers or both who gave you that advice to write about yourself and your own life and your own culture instead of aliens from outer space.
Both, interestingly enough. Some very, Doris Betts, who's a wonderful novelist and short story writer, Max Steele, Daphne Athis. And actually, the black teachers who encouraged me were critics, literary critics, Lee Green, Trudier Harris. But they, you know, they were very supportive at the same time. It was sort of pulling me away and redirecting me in a very nurturing and loving way.
Was that good advice?
I think so. There's much richer mind feels in, or minds, I should say, not mind feels, even though they can explode in your face, but much richer feels to mind in writing about your own past and that very mystical history that I grew up in southeastern North Carolina.
Does the science fiction part explain, in a way, your interest in the more magical aspects of the culture that you came from?
Undoubtedly. I'm a very recalcitrant human being, and I wasn't going to give up that easily. But at the same time, I have a feeling that they were never really at odds. I mean, I found a way to maintain my interest in manipulating the world, shall we say, or finding another way to look at the world. And so even though I'm not writing about starships and laser guns, I am writing about a type of reality that, you know, you don't see on the 6 o'clock news. But it doesn't eradicate or obviate the 6 o'clock news, but it gives us another way of looking at the 6 o'clock news.
You were at one time thinking of becoming a minister, yes?
It did flit through my mind on occasion, yes.
Oh, and when was that, and why did you want to?
Well, I grew up very much, very, very pious, so to speak. I mean, it was a very strong Baptist tradition. And even now, most of my closest friends are ministers or theologians, oddly enough. I can't explain it because I'm something of a hellraiser. So I have always been fascinated by theology, by the Bible. I was made to learn it thoroughly growing up. And it still holds a certain fascination.
Mm-hmm. How come you didn't become a minister?
Because I'm too much of a hellraiser. No. an ongoing quarrel with Christendom, I think. The church proper, the way it goes about its business.
It expected things of you that you weren't willing to do.
Well, no, not so much of me, but just the way it goes about the business, what it thinks it's, the way it interprets its mandate, mm-hmm. and the way I interpret its mandate are very much at odds.
Mm-hmm.
And so I prefer to work on the fringes as opposed to becoming a part of the system just yet.
Mm-hmm. Who were the storytellers in your family?
My cousin Norman, Leslie Norman, who lived across the road from me in the house built by my great-great-grandfather, he was probably the most impressive and the most enthralling storyteller I have ever known. And, you know, I was around him literally every day. He took his meals at our house when his wife died. And he was a profound influence on me, language-wise, the way I see the world, the way I think about the dead and that sort of thing.
Randall Keenan, his new collection of short stories, Let the Dead Bury Their Dead, is published by Harcourt Bryce Stevanovich.
¶¶
That's Moaning from the Charles Mingus album Blues and Roots. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. President Bush is asking Congress to approve some money for forestation in developing countries around the world. He's recommending spending up to $270 million in fiscal 1993. Critics say he's doing this to divert attention from what they feel is a somewhat weak position on global warming. Complaints are coming in from Europe, from European community members, that the U.S. is trying to dominate the Earth Summit that starts this week in Rio de Janeiro. From Serbia, Silvia Pajoli reports that Serbia's president, Slobodan Milosevic, remains defiant in the face of economic embargoes and that Milosevic seems to have a great deal of popular support.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's been 3 years since the Beastie Boys released their last album, and a lot has happened in rap music. But rock critic Ken Tucker says the Beastie Boys have more than caught up with the times on their new album, Check Your Head.
When I told my producer here that I was planning to review the new Beastie Boys album, she snapped, "Why? They never had any talent to begin with." I guess a lot of people feel this way, so rather than just praising the ingenuity and cleverness of Check Your Head, I have to offer a justification for this trio's career, their very existence. The Beastie Boys have turned off a lot of listeners with their image, that of bratty, privileged white kids whose most famous manifesto was a whine about how you have to fight for your right to party. Leaving aside the fact that Fight for Your Right was a good piece of music, powerfully catchy, the Beasties, Adam Horovitz, Adam Yauch, and Mike Diamond, were always something more than creepy fraternity boys. On their critically praised but commercially failed second album, Paul's Boutique, they perfected a psychedelically breezy attitude in their lyrics. It's a style that's the unacknowledged forerunner of current hip-hop acts like PM Dawn, Cypress Hill, and Basshead. And on the new Check Your Head, the Beastie Boys are making thick, dense music that doesn't sound like anything that anyone else is doing. Check Your Head is filled with rhythms that baby boomers can respond to, the bass and drum sounds of Booker T and the MGs, the Bar K's, and the ultimate New Orleans group, the Meters. At least a third of Check Your Head consists of instrumentals in homage to these influences, and, unusual in hip-hop music, the Beasties are playing their own instruments, as on this salute to the jazz keyboardist Richard Groove Holmes. I think the Beastie's instrumentals come out of a desire to do something different, but also because in 1992, being a white rap act is dicier than ever. Your lyrics make you a target. Taking any sort of militant stance leaves white rappers open to the charges of cultural inauthenticity, while just goofing around, making jokes, can get you compared to a lame-o like Vanilla Ice. The Beastie's shrewd response has been to just clam up for some of the time on Check Your Head, and when they do speak, they create maddeningly intricate layers of sound, verbal and musical collages whose meanings will never be clear. By combining artistic abstraction with studio innovation, the Beastie Boys aren't annoying clowns anymore. The question is there an audience out there open-minded enough to give them the credit they deserve?
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, Ron Barron, and Bob Balls. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Novelist Terry McMillan has been called the creator of a new literary genre, the post-feminist black urban romance novel. McMillan writes about love, but she's not trying to be Danielle Steele. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with McMillan about why being single isn't as much fun as it used to be. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.